Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, where we celebrate top performers producing better results in less time. I'm your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning, as is most often the case, is my good buddy and co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Stone. How are things in your world?
Going well. Holly really is working from home here on out, and so we're excited about that, and it's my birthday week slash month slash quarter.
Man, we've been talking about your birthday, it seems, for weeks now.
I know, and tomorrow is the actual day, 5-0, and so I have an exciting week coming up, and I am in anticipation of several presents and gifts.
And why are you looking at me? I got you a book.
Terrific. Well, let's go ahead and start talking about that book. We'll just launch right in. We have a studio full, but first up on the High Velocity Radio Show this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce from Laddering Works, LLC, and author of Laddering, Unlocking the Potential of Consumer Behavior, Mr. Eric Holtzclaw. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. You sound like one of my friends who celebrates their birthday for like 6 months prior to the time that it actually comes up. There's some of us who try to skip it, and
exactly.
Some of us are just like, it's my birthday.
So Laddering Works, works for who, works for why? What are you out there trying to do for folks?
So we're a marketing strategy firm. So we work with customers to help them understand who their customers are. So it sounds like a crazy question, but most of the time, companies really don't know who their customers are and who they're selling to. And they need to have a deeper understanding of their customers, especially in today's economy, to build products and services and marketing messages that are really niche and really go after those products or those customers in the right way.
So when you say that the company doesn't know who their customers are, they have customers, right? That's the first assumption.
That's the first assumption. Though I do work with a lot of startups who are trying to determine, who their customers are. And the problem they have is they typically assume things like quantifiable data. So they'll look at, you know, market segmentation, people are between the ages of 35 and 50 who drive a minivan and have 2.5 kids. And that is not why someone buys a product from you, reacts to a marketing message, or decides to choose your service.
So that's too broad?
That is way too broad, especially in today's world. So those are kind of old mechanisms that were invented over 100 years ago.
Right.
And I cover that in the first part of the book and talk about why we are where we are today, and then talk about what you really need to do today to really understand who your customers are and what you need to do for those customers.
Now 100 years ago, or even, say, 50 years ago, that may have made sense because the media wasn't as fragmented so that they could reach a bunch of people and they didn't have to be as precise.
There were a couple of problems. So we could only mass produce products.
Right.
So everything, you know, Henry Ford said you could have any color you want as long as it was black.
Right.
So as soon as you start customizing, you had an issue. And mass media. So you could only send things over a mass channel. So we only had a few number of channels, those types of things. The world broke in the last decade, and you can have almost any color you want, and you know anything you want to about it. And as Desiree's going to talk about in a second, you can send the right message to the right person at the right time, and that's really what they expect. So we went from this mass channel, and we understand we can build mass products. But as advertisers and marketers and companies, we still think that that's the way that we promote our products and services to different customers and that we build those products. So you'll see companies sitting behind boardroom doors talking about quant data, segmentation, looking for a large enough group to go after. And really what they need to be doing is understanding who their customers are, what their customers want from them. So instead of thinking about product first, they need to think about customer first and then build products and services that really fit within that customer's ecosystem.
So tell us about this term laddering. What does that mean and how does it apply to this conversation?
So what happened is I basically hijacked a term. So the term was invented back in the 1980s, and it was invented around the concept of taking like a stereo system that you could only mass produce, and then it would end up on the marketer's desk, right? The company decided to build this stereo system, and they've got to figure out how to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would ladder the stereo system. They would figure out what features and functions were the most important to the customer and have them rank order them. And then once they chose one of those features, they would ask the customer why 5 times. Why is this important to you? Until they got down to really the core reason why that product really worked for them. So for example, a stereo system might have a CD changer. So they'll say, which feature is the most important to you? They say the CD changer. And then you start to layer down below that and you realize the reason the CD changer is cool to them is that when they have friends over, they can look like they're the DJ and they don't have to change the music in the background.
Right.
So that's how they would sell the product.
That's really what they want, and the customer thinks that the CD changer is the path to it, but there may be better paths that they're just not aware of.
Yeah, and it's that aspirational, making them see themselves using the product in a way, but they had to build the product. They had to sell millions of these one thing that they could create off a production line. So what happened is the world changed. And the world changed right around the same time that the economy went in the tank, right? 2008.
It's probably a coincidence.
Well, you know, but we blame a lot on the real estate, and really it has more to do with some of the products and service changes that happened at the same time. So we were able to really and truly do niche marketing around that same time. And so I think companies are still reacting from that. They think, oh, you know, we still need to do mass media, mass messaging, and that's really not the right way to do it. So instead of taking laddering and looking at a product, take it and point it at your customer and deeply understand what your customer wants. So who do they think they are today and who do they aspire to be tomorrow? And if you can build products and services and marketing messages in that world, you can be incredibly successful. And part of the reason I that, you know, I worked for a research company for about a 10
years. So you would know.
10 years, right? We did about 150 projects a year. I've talked to over 6,000 consumers in one-on-one interviews. Mm-hmm. And every time we were brought a product or a service or marketing message that wasn't working, what we found is that the assumptions they were making were incorrect. And if we took that product, service, or marketing message out and we just simply talked to the consumer that was intended for that product, we could find out really what they wanted and we could explain to them why it wasn't working.
Now, does this methodology work for B2B as it works for B2C? Because a B2C is I'm a consumer and I want something for myself.
Yeah.
But a B2B might be I'm a person who works in a company and I got to impress my boss. It may not be perfect, but it'll help me move up the ladder of my company. Like there could be another agenda in play here.
Yes. Very nice of you to say that because I really have three books in mind. So the book is Laddering, Unlocking the Potential of Consumer Behavior. And I want to write another book called Laddering, Unlocking the Potential of Your Teams, because the same kind of concepts that we have for consumers work with your teams and internally too. We struggle with trying to figure out how to motivate millennials, and there's tons of questions and conversations around that. And it's, again, because we don't really understand their core drivers, and we don't use them from what they're best at. So I have as many examples in the B2B space as I do in the B2C.
But are they – is it congruent, or they have a different – you have to attack that a little differently?
You have to understand if you're selling B2B versus managing a team internally, businesses have kind of personas. They have sort of personalities.
Right.
And you can tell the personality of a business based on the people who work at a company. So if you've ever worked at a company and you felt like you didn't fit, you probably didn't fit the personality of the company.
Right.
So that company will buy products and services in a very similar way that a business-to-consumer person would. So they have a set of beliefs.
But the five whys work in B2B?
They do. You can get down to putting business-to-business groups into clusters based on the context just as easily. And that's almost more fun sometimes because you can then look at this entity and understand why they're not succeeding in certain spaces. So 57% of business buyers have made the decision about whether or not they're going to buy a product or service from a company based on what they're finding about the product or service already on the internet, on the messages that they're receiving. So when they call in a business-to-business space, they've made the decision. The only thing your salesperson does is either screw up the deal or push it across, right?
Right.
And that number is just increasing. Like people really want to go and self-select and look for information that's important to them. They know what's important to them and what is important to their business. So you really have to be careful about what you're putting out, how you're saying it, and that you're interacting correctly with both a business-to-consumer environment and a business-to-business environment.
Now, you're already writing a column. Why write a book? And now we hear plans for two more. Isn't that a pretty big time investment?
No, I liked writing. So I started writing the column for Inc. I've actually got two running now for Inc. and then a couple things with Wall Street Journal and CMO. And I really love that medium. The book was sort of another – I'd always thought about a book. And I was asked to write it about a year ago, and I think they thought I'd write a book about entrepreneurs, which is a book I do want to write. That's number three. But this book really made sense because of the experiences I've had in this B2C space. And I just know that marketers are doing it wrong and product developers are doing it wrong. I mean, they need to go out and really understand who they're selling to, why they're selling to that person. And what's been interesting to me and an unexpected thing was I really wrote the book originally to the kind of Fortune 500 Global 2000 marketing manager to make them wake up. I mean, wake up and really look at what you're doing and why you're doing it. When I sent the book out for endorsement and had people read it before it was ready to go out, what I got back was, this is a fantastic book for startups and for small companies.
But not us. We have this figured out.
Who don't know how to do consumer discovery, right? And that was eye-opening to me, and also, you know, an example of what you should do, right? I showed it to my customers to find out what would work. So I'm really building two paths for this. One is the consulting, going in and working with a customer to understand how to impact this across the organization. Because it's not helpful to fix just your marketing message. You have to also make sure that your delivery teams, your support teams, all understand who your customer is and how to deliver the right messages at the right time to those people. Right?
Do you find that sometimes companies are kind of schizophrenic in that one arm is behaving a certain way and another, you know, they're not having...
Sometimes, all the time.
So that's very difficult then to get everybody with a congruent message and a congruent philosophy.
Yeah, and I have a slightly different perspective on it. A lot of the books that you'll read will talk about turning other people into customer advocates internally.
Right.
And while that's great, you really have to teach the systems so that the systems know, the systems that these people are interacting with, who that customer is and what the right message is to deliver to that customer. So it's not that they don't want to, it's just that it's not as important as it is to the researcher or the product manager once you get down to customer support and some of those kinds of places. They're all using different systems. They're all using different training internally. Most customers I work with have 6 to 10 systems internally and 6 to 10 groups running on top of those systems. So you have to figure out how you take the information and move it from one group to the next such that they really understand how to act against it.
Now, do you find that because in today's world there's so much information captured digitally that we can measure lots of things, and some of them, just because you can measure it doesn't mean it's the right thing to be measuring.
Exactly.
And then like when you're saying, oh, you got to ask why 5 times, that's hard to kind of put in a spreadsheet, right?
It is. I love that. You know, quant is, I'm a qual guy, always have been, and I explain problems with quant. So when you have a quantifiable problem, you know, then I go and look at it from a qualitative perspective. And if you look at Eric Ries's stuff, he talks about vanity metrics. Mm-hmm. How many times did somebody download something? I don't care. I don't care how many downloads you had. I don't care. I want to know how they're using it, why they're using it, what really drove them to that message. So it's really getting underneath it and using a qualitative lens. So looking at who's using the product or service and understanding what those quant numbers mean.
And is it really aligned with what you're trying to accomplish at the end of the day?
Absolutely.
Just because, like, you know, okay, we want more people coming to our website, so we're going to just kind of juice that up, and we're winning now. We're doing better, and it's like not impacting the bottom line because it was misaligned.
That, or you're a brand who tries to be something you're not. Mm-hmm. And I work with a lot of brands who don't really want to embrace who they are and understand how to move to where they need to go. So when we look at brands, we naturally include certain brands in our ecosystem based on how we feel about those brands and what they do for us. Mm-hmm. So we have to think about our brand or company's personality and then decide how we're going to move from one location to the next within that context. So, you know, it's not business as usual. I mean, I think that's the problem, right? You know, marketers are taught big numbers. They're taught focus groups. You know, you have to have X percent of the number of people before you send out this marketing message. They think niche market means niche product, and it doesn't. Niche market means the right message, but selling potentially the same product. So it's very, very...
So it's the messaging is the most important thing. You have to talk to the right people in the right way.
Yeah, and most of the stuff we're selling nowadays is messaging and content and virtual and not really physically available, right?
Right.
My favorite example is, you know, I had an Atari 800 or 2600, one of those game systems earlier, and you would go to Walmart and it would be $50 to buy a game, right? Well, by the time you got home, if you hated the game, you probably still played it, right?
Because you were stuck with the sunk costs, right?
And now you download it for $1 or free, and if you don't like it, it just becomes litter on your smartphone and you move on. You've got to get down to right message, right place, right time. What's the value to me? So to do that, you need to understand who I am. You need to understand what kind of messages need to come back to me. It's not about building for enough people. It's about building the right thing for the right people.
So how does the day-to-day sales and marketing work for you personally? How do you get to have these kinds of conversations with people who should be working with you?
Well, I have – that's part of writing the book.
You write a book. Get a column.
Right? Yeah.
Write a book from Wiley.
So, 4 Steps to Success by Eric.
No. I mean the frustration, honestly, I had as working just as a researcher or working with just product groups is that I couldn't impact the change across the organization that I really wanted to. Mm-hmm. So building vehicles – and Inc. just happens to be the coolest blog on the face of the planet, right? I talk about things I see that are not working in the product and marketing or entrepreneurial world. But everyone should have some type of awareness that's going on. They should have content out, you know, a blog that they're writing, tweeting, Facebook, whatever their social media channel of choice is, and then nurturing information out to those people so that they can learn from you moving forward. What I've learned with the book and recently launched is, even though I wrote a book, it's not enough. And so I've launched a nurturing program that lets people get answers from me, you know, hey, how do you do focus groups, or what does a paper prototype work like? And that allows me to stay in communication with people and let them understand kind of what I know and how to move forward.
So we could do that. We could have people write in, Stone, when is your next birthday?
That's right.
Stone, you're obsessed with your birthday.
Yeah, a little bit.
But that does say a lot about your core DNA, actually. So,
how many whys deep are we in this?
Why you don't have to go very wide on that, very deep on that. I can pretty much peg him based on that.
So now, obviously, relationships are important in this whole equation, and that's kind of, I guess, a little bit of a pivot for these larger organizations, because it was kind of impersonal, right? They were selling lots of things to lots of people. They didn't have to get to know them very well. And now I think what I'm hearing is that you're saying that relationships are super important to get to know them intimately so you can sell them the right thing when they're ready for it.
Yeah, so and the little secret is that we're collecting all this big data on people because we think within a world we need to understand everything about you.
Right.
Which isn't true. It's just I need to understand 3 to 5 things about you, but they're not the 3 to 5 things I'm used to tracking.
They're not obvious. They're not
that you're male or female. They're not that you have so many kids or so much income. It's do you project or not? Do you need to be affirmed or not? Mm-hmm. Those are the types of core DNA we really need to understand. And within a context, if we understand that, then we've got you. And we can build products for you. We can message you. For example, Starbucks. I love Starbucks. Came in this morning with my Starbucks. All Starbucks really needs to know is that in the morning, I order a Cafe Americano, a Grande Cafe Americano, everywhere I go. If they knew that when I walked in, then I'd be happy with Starbucks. Not that there's anything that would probably make me unhappy with Starbucks, but it's really thinking about those few things. And I think that marketers and product managers and some of the others look at, they want to collect all this data because they think they're going to have another epiphany like we did from the demographic and segmentation data of the 70s and 80s when we controlled the media, we controlled the production. And really, truly, it's more about just understanding within your context the appropriate things you need to know about your consumer. It's not as hard. It really is not.
Now, you're speaking at an upcoming conference we were talking about just before we went on air, I think.
Yes. There's a customer engagement summit that's at the end of September. It's being put on by a company called Possible Now, which they're the industry leader in managing customer preferences. And I'll be emceeing that over a two-day period at the end of September. It's the 26th and 27th. And it's a very cool conference. We've got lots of big names coming in, Ernst & Young, Chick-fil-A, SAP, Marketo, Responsys, people like that, to talk about how you engage with your customers appropriately and really have these conversations and move forward.
So now, who would attend a conference like that?
It's very appropriate to like a marketing person. So I also believe that product people need to understand this better. So if you're a product manager building a product internally, you so often have to advocate with so many different groups who the customer is. So you may have built the product, but unless it gets supported at the end, then you really may not have a success. And they're often the person who has kind of their feet held to the fire. So definitely anyone in marketing responsible for a product, a marketing director type person.
Now, are there certain industries or certain groups of people that this resonates more with, or some like your manufacturing, are they, you know, not ready for it yet, but like, you know, marketing and professional services are?
I've done stuff. You're talking about for the summit or for the work
The work you do and the summit.
I've ridden tractors all over the world. Applying these techniques to understand how to build the ladder, the tractors, and make sure that they have the right interfaces. I've done this on CPG, on consumer goods, digital goods. It really applies to everything that we can build because we can really customize everything. The only thing that you get down to is very commodity-driven product, right? But commodity often has to differentiate itself, especially in a higher economy like the U.S., where we have so much choice. You know, I was reading gluten-free, you know, the concept of gluten-free.
Right.
Only 1% of the population is gluten.
Right, it's celiac issue. Right.
And so if we can support that group, then you can support almost any group that wants something. And maybe the same product with just a slight twist to it.
So where can our listeners learn more and get their hands on this book?
So the book is available everywhere. Please. You can buy it at Amazon, so on Amazon.com. If you want a signed copy, you can buy it from my website, which is www.latteringworks.com. You can also sign up for my consumer interview tips, which will come out every Wednesday. They are some answers to some questions I've gotten from doing appearances like this or speaking. So I talk about topics like focus groups and, you know, when to use them, when to not. They're less than 2 minutes to make sure that I'm not wasting your time. So, and love to get questions. You can follow me on Twitter. I love to answer and talk to people on Twitter all the time, too. So, yeah.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you join us on our 100% gluten-free and dolphin-safe programming. And we'd love to have you back from time to time and get us caught up on what you're learning out there.
Or we'll just read your column on air. How would that be?
That'd be great. I would love that. It comes out every Thursday.
All right, I'll just read it. Eric couldn't be here, but here's what he had to say.
That'd be great.
That's perfect. Hey, how about hanging out with us while we visit with our next guest?
I'd love to.
All right, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, we have with us Mr. Doug Eisenberg with the Gigalaw Firm. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we are delighted to have you. What did you learn from that last segment? You looked like you were paying attention.
I was paying a lot of attention, and I think what Eric said about the book and about social media and about writing, it's all a part of a large package. You know, I'm a lawyer, but obviously anybody that's got anything to sell, whether it's a product or a service that you can touch or not touch, it has to be in the marketing business. So I picked up a lot from that, and I look forward to reading Eric's book.
Now, internet law, is that a specialty nowadays?
It is. You know, I've been practicing law for 17, 18 years now, and when I started out, you know, the internet was really just starting out. So internet law was not a defined area of the law. I certainly started law school not knowing anything about technology law, and now it's a pretty common practice. There are a lot of issues online, whether you're a consumer and want to protect yourself against bad guys, or whether you are a larger company operating your own website, selling your own products or services, or just advertising yourself online. Obviously, you need to be very careful what you're doing online to make sure that you've protected yourself and that your consumers can find you and not the bad guys.
So what are some of the bad guys doing that is illegal or rude or shady? Or, what should we be looking out for?
Or all of the above.
Right.
You know, it's funny. There's a term that a lot of people laugh at the first time they hear it, but obviously I've been dealing with it for many years, but it's called cyber squatting. You can kind of chuckle under your breath, but it's a real problem online. Cyber squatting is basically describes what happens when somebody registers a domain name, an internet domain name that contains your trademark or is similar to your trademark.
Like mylattering.com. I was going to get that after the show.
That's exactly right. It may be gone now.
I hope everyone's listening.
A cyber squatter goes out and registers a domain name that contains somebody else's trademark or is similar to somebody else's trademark and puts up a website. In the old days, that website used to have a lot of porn on it. Today, you see just a lot of websites with a bunch of affiliate links. It looks like a lot of junk content, but somebody's making a couple of cents or fractions of a cent every time you click on one of those links. And because you can register a domain name for about $10 a year, if you've got a large enough portfolio of domain names, as a lot of cyber squatters do, you can actually make a living off of this practice. Now, it's illegal in many ways, depending upon what you're doing. So what I do in my practice typically is represent the good guys, of course, and help them take down these websites or go after these cyber squatters and get the domain names transferred to them, because ultimately it's harming their business and it's harming the consumers because folks are ending up at websites and places where they don't want to be.
And I have a question, Anna. We need some advice. We are Business Radio X, and that's a trademark entity. Somebody has at Business Radio X on Twitter. Is there anything we can do about that, or is that just tough luck?
Oh, well, the obvious answer is maybe.
That's the obvious answer.
Because he is a lawyer.
But the bigger,
he's legit.
Yeah.
The bigger question is, with so many social media outlets popping up every which way, if somebody kind of just grabs that URL or that name within that social media outlet, does the company that has, especially if it's trademarked, have any rights to getting that back?
It depends in part on what social media network you're talking about. It also depends in part on what the bad guy or the other person, if you will, is actually doing with it. You know, years ago, and by years ago, I mean, you know, two years ago.
Right, because it'll change rapidly.
Tony La Russa, the Major League Baseball manager, was one of the first who actually filed a trademark infringement lawsuit against Twitter because they allowed somebody else to register the Twitter handle at Tony La Russa. And that case settled pretty quickly. But the different social media networks, whether they're Facebook or Google Plus or Twitter, you know, have their own rules. And for the most part, we're sort of stuck having to play by their rules. Now, a domain name itself, if it's actually, you know, businessradiox.com,
right,
for example, or tonylarussa.com, fortunately, there's a different set of rules that apply there. And there's an arbitration policy. It's a lot of the work that I do in that area that's been around since 1999. But a lot of the social media networks are kind of making up the rules as they go. And sometimes a little bit of arm twisting with one of the social media networks goes a long way.
But like, say Eric decides to start a social media network called laddering.com. And I go in there and I take the username Coca-Cola. Now, Coca-Cola, obviously, they have a lot of lawyers and trademarks. So you're saying that it would depend on what his rules are in his social network?
Yeah, that's right. He can set the rules for his own social network now, depending upon what you do.
If I was disparaging Coca-Cola, then they'd probably be more fired up to get me to stop.
Yeah, although interestingly, the disparaging issues and what we lawyers sometimes call gripe sites, that is where somebody's actually complaining about another company, sort of one of the legendary cases involved a website called WalmartSucks.com. A lot of that is, really protected by the First Amendment. So, yes, it is certainly using somebody else's trademark, but if you're using it in a way that provides your opinion, just because the trademark owner doesn't like your opinion, so long as you're truthful, then you may, under certain circumstances, have the right to use that.
So are they allowed to say WalmartSucks.com?
Yes, they are.
Oh, wow.
But on the other side of the coin, a domain name is not the same as getting a trademark, and it's not enough. Like, it would have been ill-advised for us to just go get businessradiox.com and not get the trademark. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I have operated a website for 13 years or so now at gigalaw.com, G-I-G-A-L-A-W. About the same time that I registered the domain name was at the same time that I applied for a federal trademark registration because the two are sort of two sides of the same coin. You can have a trademark without a domain name, and you can have a domain name without a trademark. But if you want full protection, you really need both. And it is, you know, something that a lot of business owners sometimes forget because it's a lot cheaper and a lot quicker to go register a domain name. As I said before, you know, in the next 5 minutes and $10, you can have a domain name. You cannot get a federal trademark registration for that amount of money and that amount of time. It's going to take hundreds of dollars, depending upon how the process goes, perhaps thousands of dollars, although not a lot of thousands, and a year or two before you might get a federal trademark registration. But it is something that will be very powerful to you later on as you might try to enforce your rights down the road.
So now, regarding the intellectual property that you put on this website, is there any protections for, like, photographs or the content? Because a lot of, you know, there's so many websites nowadays and so many blogs that people just scrape the content and throw it on their website and make it seem like it's theirs.
Yeah, you know, a dozen years or so ago, the mantra was, you know, information just wants to be free. Well, maybe not. Just because you can take somebody else's content from their website, whether it's a photograph, as you said, or text, or any other content on a website, just because it's easy to take doesn't mean that you have the legal right to take it. You know, I can easily walk out of the convenience store with a product, that I didn't pay for. Not that I ever have and not that I ever would, but just because it's easy to do something obviously does not make it legal. So, yes, certainly if you are blogging, if you're creating your own website, if you're posting your own social media posts, then you should be aware of the type of content that you're using. And if you have your own website, and of course everybody does now, you know, there's some things you can do if you find out that somebody has taken your content, and protect yourself. And, you know, you don't just need to turn a blind eye. And it's important, you know, to enforce your rights. And then you sort of build up a reputation too, as somebody who says, hey, I'm, you know, going to pursue you, if you copy the content off of my website. Now, some people are sort of flattered, you know, imitation is the greatest form of flattery I know. And there are those, you know, if you've written an article or written a blog post, maybe you're happy, for somebody else to, post, or repost a part of it. If they link back to you and let their audience know where the original content came from. But if they're simply reposting it as their own and using it as their own and using your intellectual property and the time and effort that you've spent for their own benefit, then that's you know, most likely copyright infringement or trademark infringement or both.
How do you even know if someone's doing it?
Well, I use a search engine called Google a lot, and it's amazing because, you know, again, back in the days, you know, and there was a time before Google existed, and I was practicing internet law before Google did exist, you know, that was in and of itself just part of the challenge, trying to find other, you know, websites, you know, who is actually causing the problems. You know, now it's easy to find them, and the issue really is not so much finding them, but trying to make a decision about which ones are worth pursuing. Because frankly, you know, if you are popular enough, if your content is popular enough, then, you know, there's going to be a lot of flattery out there. and then you've got to make selective decisions about who is worth pursuing and who is not.
Now, do you have a sweet spot, a vertical or a size of organization that you find yourself working with more often than others?
No, it's really interesting because, you know, obviously, as I said before, and as we all know, everybody's got a website.
Yeah.
You can be in business and the only, you know, person who's working for your business, or you can be a part of a, you know, Fortune 5 company. And the issues are frankly the same. Now, maybe a larger company is going to run into these issues more frequently. So, you know, I work with very large companies that, you know, are perpetually facing these problems online, facing cyber squatters and copyright infringers and so forth. And, you know, they've got problems every day. A smaller business might have a problem once. So, you know, I work with small companies too. They've got, well, you know, perhaps one domain name that's ever going to be a problem for them. And maybe it's an unusual situation where it's one of their employees, even if it's a very small company, but, you know, one employee registered the domain name and put up the website, and now, guess what? That employee's on the outs and no longer works for the company, and he's got the keys to the domain name and to the website, and, you know, my client wants to get them back, and what do they do about it? So that may be the only issue that they ever face, and once they've got it resolved, that's it. But frankly, the issues are the same no matter how big you are. You know, as we all know, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog, and, you know, nobody knows how large you are online necessarily either.
Now, what if you're a company and then you have writers that write for your blog? Is there ways that you can protect yourself so that that content stays yours and it isn't the person who is the creator of it?
You know, copyright law in the United States is pretty interesting, and it is very protective for the author. And authors can be artists and sculptors and software programmers and so forth. But sure, when it comes to blog content, you know, we're all authors. And by default, an author is the owner of his or her copyright. Now, if that author is an employee of a company, then perhaps there's something called the work made for hire doctrine, which says that the employer rather than the employee owns that content. But if you were operating a blog and you allow guest posts on your blog, then you certainly want to think in advance, what rules do you want to apply to that guest post content? Is that content that you want to own? Or is it simply content that you want to license, that is, that you want, you know, permission to use? And, you know, there may not be an immediate difference today, but if the author later says, I want you to take down this blog post that I did for you 3 years ago because I no longer like you, or for whatever reason, if they're the copyright owner and you don't have a contract that gives you the right to keep that content up there, if you keep it up, you'll actually be committing copyright infringement, even if it's your blog. On the other hand, you know, perhaps you want the rights to some of these guest blog posts because maybe you're compiling a book of your own. and you want the right to include some of these contributions in your book. So a lot of this can be addressed by contract. It's also part of what I do in my legal practice is help my clients think through these issues, because they're certainly a lot easier to address today. You know, when there are no problems and when everybody's got good relationships, than they are down the road when things go south.
Well, in your world, I'm sure it's true of law in general, but certainly in your world, it has to be magnified. Things must change a lot. The regulations must change. The laws must change. The case law, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I wrote a book 11 years ago now, The Gigalaw Guide to Internet Law, that Random House published. And it's kind of interesting because I tell people pretty frequently, you know, that's obviously a long time ago in the scheme of things as to the advancements in technology. All the issues that existed then still exist today. So it's not as if any of the issues are going away. We're just seeing new issues arise. Obviously, Facebook and Twitter did not exist then, but the same underlying issues, copyright and trademark infringement, have been around for a long time. So it's a matter sometimes of trying to reinterpret some new laws in the light of new technology. But I tell my clients all the time, I've stopped saying I'm surprised, because frankly, I am surprised all the time. So I'm, it's like expect the unexpected. Things that bad guys do online never cease to amaze me. So, we can't create new laws every day or every week or every month to deal with these issues. So it's just often a matter of time of using the existing laws that we have to see how they work in the context of new technology.
Where can our listeners go to learn more?
Well, there are a lot of places. Of course, a couple I recommend. I have had a website, as I said before, called gigalaw.com, GIGALAW.com, for about 13 years, where now I sort of collect and curate news content about internet law development. So there are a handful or two or three or four handfuls of news developments, believe it or not, every day, where I track these issues from copyright and trademark infringement to patent issues, privacy, cyber squatting, even employment law issues and so forth online. And then I've the website for my law firm is gigalawfirm.com.
Well, thanks for coming down and visiting with us and, scaring the heck out of us, right? Because we have all this user-generated content.
Exactly.
Across our whole network, we are personally probably responsible for maybe as much as a third of it, but a great deal of our content is user-generated by our clients and our power partners, associations, and so now you got my wheels clicking. So, thanks for that.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, you going to hang with us while we visit with our next guest?
Of course.
All right. Next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, we have with us no stranger to the Business Radio X microphone from Bella Web Design, Miss Desiree Scales. How you doing, sunshine?
Hey, I'm great. Thank you, Stone. Thank you, Lee, for inviting me again.
Well,
really
we are delighted to have you. What's going on new in the world of marketing, online marketing, web design, that kind of stuff?
Well, it's interesting. And Eric, you and I go way back as well. Nice to see you
nice
too.
To see you. It was a surprise.
Yes. What Eric is talking about in his book and about customer avatars, basically, and knowing your customer, that's going to be really important for anybody who has a presence online. And Eric, just like you were saying, if your website doesn't talk to that person that, you're that perfect customer for your business, you have to know who your customer is. So that's a great, I can't wait to dive into your book.
So I look forward to your thoughts.
So you're kind of buying into what Eric's saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I think he's on to something.
So when you're dealing with your clients, how do you move them into understanding that this should be a priority when you're developing a website?
Well, that's the first thing that we need to talk about with our client is, who's your audience? Who are you speaking to? What kind of images turn them on? What kind of, do they want a simple website that's got a lot of white space? Or, do they need a lot of messaging? Who is your perfect client?
Because sometimes the client you know, they get bored with their website, or their spouse doesn't like it, or like a, you know, an in-law hates the color, you know, and all of a sudden now they're making marketing decisions based on the data point of one person who is probably not even the person they care about.
Absolutely. And it's not even their customer market.
Right.
And that's dangerous.
Do you see that happen?
Absolutely. All the time. You know, and the worst case is when the business owner has made a decision and we've developed this great site, and then all of a sudden, like you said, somebody in the company that we didn't even know existed looks at the site and says, I don't like that color red. We've got to change it to green. So that can cause a lot of issues as, you know, far as scope creep. But then there's no business decision as to why green is better, or, you know, why this message is better.
Right. The
it's
thought just entered their
feeling.
Head.
Yeah.
Right. And now we're all, everybody's moving like that's the gospel now.
Right. You can't design a site based on your gut feeling. You've got to have some real data behind it. So I think everyone should read Eric's book before they design
before they,
a site with
before
us.
Before they talk to you.
Absolutely.
I guess the $10 I gave you before the show.
That's right. But, so, you know, it goes beyond that. It goes beyond web design. It goes beyond social media. And over the past 2-3 years that I've been blogging and participating in social media, the thing I hear most is people's frustration about social media. It's not measurable. I don't know if I'm doing it right. Why am I wasting my time here? How do I do it? And, you know, the bottom line is you've got to look beyond social media, because it's we have to step beyond that and look at messaging and delivering the right message to people at the right time. And guess what the number one social media, you know, avenue is, really, and that we use every single day that people forget about?
What?
Think about it. Would you just check on your phone?
I would say it's email.
Email.
Yeah. Email is still king.
So, but that's like the stepchild, the people don't
still game,
it's not, but it's not sexy, you know. It's not the Pinterest, or it's not
no.
you know, these other more Instagram, but it's email that's kind of the lifeblood.
It is, and it can be sexy if you do it the right way.
That's your tweetable moment.
There you go. Email can be sexy if you do it the right
moments,
way.
Tweetable moments? Is that what we look for now?
That's right.
You're writing this stuff down for the clip.
That was a tweetable moment, and you missed it.
Sexy email.
So we have this clip show. You know, we have an AM partner in Viz 1190, and Dana Barrett does this clip show, and so we try to get quotes from the shows we do throughout the week.
There
Kevin,
you, go.
You cannot let that one go. It has to be on our clip show.
There you go. So it all has to do with what's called life cycle marketing.
Okay, so describe what that means.
Life cycle marketing is a 7-step cycle that we take people through, from attracting, you know, people to your website. You want to get people there through social media, through guest blogging,
so
through
any means
books.
Necessary, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Get them there. You
get
know,
them there.
Get them there. And we've got great tools that are free
right.
in most cases to do that.
All right.
But then once they get there and they fill out your form, or, you know, maybe they don't fill out your form, or maybe they don't call, how do we get them to do that? You know, how do we? And then once they contact you, if they're compelled, you know, you've got to have a lead magnet on your site. Maybe Eric gives, you know, part of a chapter away.
Every other word.
Every other word. There you go.
Of the entire book. Every other word.
That'd be great.
And then they got to pay for it. You get the fill in
the rest of it. Right.
Yep. So once you've captured that data, what are you doing to convert? How many times do you have to call people or convert them with an email or note, something that, you know, gets them to finally buy from you? And a lot of business owners, that is a scary thing. They drop the ball. They contact them once or twice.
That's where money changes hands, right?
Absolutely.
You'd think that'd be the most important part.
And they're afraid. They're afraid to hear no. They're afraid of rejection. That is a human response. I am guilty of that, just like anybody else. But once you get the sale, then what happens? You know, then we're moving along. Well, you've got to deliver and satisfy and make
right.
sure they get a wow experience from you. And so, you know, kind of you asked this question. By the way, happy birthday to you.
Well,
and, you know, my
you.
Birthday was last Tuesday.
Is
so I am still celebrating my birthday week. As Chris,
we're surrounded by
yeah, I Chris Brogan mentioned that in his newsletter yesterday. That was pretty
mentioned
funny.
Mentioned your birthday?
Yes.
Or
he said Desiree Scales is still enjoying her birthday week. I thought that was hilarious.
That's fantastic. Kevin, would you please
tweet? That says a lot about you.
Chris Brogan yeah. and let him know that he probably already knows, but just in case, let Chris Brogan know.
I think we should bring Doug back to have him mention your birthday.
Exactly.
I think we missed that opportunity.
We're going to sing happy birthday at the end, I'm sure. So I want to ask something about this no, because I'm under the impression, and maybe it's just my fanciful dream, but particularly with the advent of all the technology and all the drip campaign stuff and all the psychological insight Eric has, for people that do say no, at least for now, can it just be a happy no and a no not right now? And we can still be nice to them and come back and take another swing at them later, right?
Absolutely. And that's another great point that people forget. They let those no's be the closed door. They don't realize there's a window open and they still may want to hear from you every once in a while. So, you know, depending on how long your sales cycle is, that's how many times you should, you know, try to convert them still. I mean, you should always try. Hey, you know, you were on our website and you wanted this from us maybe a month ago. It didn't quite work out. Did you find what you needed? Guess what? They may come back and say, no, I forgot about you guys, but hey, I'm going to buy from you because you remembered me.
But now, doesn't that, and that goes to your point, Eric, is that it takes a relationship to pull that off. It's not a transaction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of businesses think of things in terms of transaction. They bought or they sold. You know, it's on or it's off. And then there's a lot of gray area here.
Yeah, and I think the problem, too, is that marketing has always thought of themselves as a transactional organization and sales as a relationship organization. Mm-hmm. And that's really flipped. Marketing is about relationship and sales is about the transaction.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it goes beyond relationships. What it is now is education. Because somebody comes to you because they want to learn what you know. So, Eric, you know, I want to learn what you know about laddering and personal relationships, business relationships. So now Eric has the chance to create an online course to maybe teach me. I mean, there are other ways, multiple channels to educate. And this is the beauty, the beauty of the internet and what we have now is we have so many different channels to share our expertise and help other people. It's fascinating.
Now, internet is built for niches, right? And that's the kind of the big transition that's happened, whereas the television has one show at a time. There was only a handful of networks when we were younger, and now there's infinite number of channels.
Yeah, well, if you look at television, it's actually a sign of what's happening to the internet, right? We used to have three channels. Now we have, you know, I couldn't fall asleep last night, so I watched HGTV because that would definitely put you out, right? So we have shows that are very niche, and so that's social media networks, websites, all those are going to that kind of concept, and it's really about the niche.
Right, we had somebody from the Weather Channel, one of the founders of the Weather Channel on, and he was talking about, when I had this idea for the Weather Channel, like people were like, what are you, insane? Like who is going to watch a channel that's just the weather? You know, like before it was just a few minutes on the local news was the only place you get the weather. And now he's going to build a 24/7 channel on the weather.
And my wife is very happy he did.
You know what would be really cool, though, if the Weather Channel took it a step further and actually had classes that taught us what weather is and what it means, you know, what exactly is the red area, compared to the green, and how do they, you know, how does the radar work? I mean, there are people who would lap that up with a spoon, and, you know, so they could take it a step further
and just
grow
get deeper and deeper and deeper into the minutiae of their business where there's fans that probably want to eat all that up.
Yeah, absolutely. And they would be branded and people would pay for that information, I bet, you know.
Now, do you get any of those looks when you go in and you want to take this level of discipline and rigor to website design and, you know, the CFO or says, well, my niece has a great little website. We're just going to have her do it. You get some of those same looks.
I get that all the time. But you know what? And that's great. And let her, hey, I'll teach her how to build it. I really will. Right. You know, I will teach her how to use WordPress and build it. She'll have to pay me to do it. And then she's going to end up finding out that it's much more than putting images on a page. I mean, there's really theory behind how websites work. Again, knowing your audience, you know, there's a lot behind it. And then how does your site sell for you? Does your site upsell? Is it a place that your customers want to keep coming back to? And learning more, you know, it becomes your platform. It really becomes the place where people keep going back to learn more about you. And then you can upsell them to your different channels, to your classes, or maybe to your seminars, or, you know, just there's so many things that you can do. Video, that's the most underutilized thing that we can put on a website that I think people are missing. Put video on. People want to see your personality. They want to, you know, capture your essence and see what you're about, and they're going to listen, you know, five times more than they would just reading something.
Right. Like a website isn't a set it and forget it thing. It's a living, breathing thing that it has to be constantly evolving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, you know, the last part of lifecycle marketing is asking for referrals. If you've done a great job and you know, your customers are happy, why not ask them for a referral? I think that's another thing that's scary for a lot of business owners. And you can automate all of this with software that is out there. That's the beauty of it. So, yeah, it's just a great it's taking it to the next level.
Well, and Eric said early in the program, some 57% of people, this is their experience of you before you ever get to have a chance to have the face-to-face conversation.
That's
right.
Right.
So, I mean, this is critically important.
Yeah, and I get calls all the time as a business owner saying, hey, you know, we chose you because you have a lot of great content out there. You taught us something that we didn't know. And if you can give little golden nuggets on your website, I feel like I write a book every week, you know, honestly, writing a blog, you know, and there are people that write every single day, and you really can, you can package that and create a book out of it, but keep educating your customers. I can't stress that enough. That's really important.
So every time I'm out and about on the town, I go to some type of event, or we find ourselves doing a remote broadcast on behalf of an association or at a trade show. Yeah. If it's in Atlanta, Desiree is there. You got anything on your calendar coming up in the coming months that...
I know you're going to be going to Eric's thing.
Yeah, well, I probably will. I've got a lot going on. I'm actually working with the Small Business Development Center in Atlanta, and I'm going to be speaking to their Grow Smart classes. I'm doing a lot more education with smaller groups, so I'm really excited about that. I just put in a product camp, potential talk that I'm going to give, a workshop on lifecycle marketing. That's my shtick, guys, lifecycle marketing. This is what you're going to hear from me for a long time. And that's actually created the way that this has come into my sphere is I've become an Infusionsoft certified consultant over the last 6 months, which was huge for me. And Scott Martineau is one of the founders of Infusionsoft and taught me, you know, about lifecycle marketing and how powerful it is. So with, you know, along with the right software and having a website that really educates, it's really important.
So now Infusionsoft, what is Infusionsoft?
Infusionsoft is a sales and marketing tool and a customer relationship management software that runs in the cloud. You can manage your entire enterprise off Infusionsoft, and then you can market to your customers automatically. You can pretty much create online classes that people can sign up for anytime, and they can start automatically. I like to say automagically is right. My word. I love it. So automagically connecting with your customers. If somebody fills out your form on your website, if you're not calling them or connecting with them within 30 minutes to 1 hour, you've lost them because they're
really?
Already on to the next person.
So this Infusionsoft, it integrates with your website. They all play nicely together.
They
so
sure
that
do.
So that the lead comes in, it goes into a CRM system so you can actively communicate with them.
Absolutely, yeah.
Good stuff. And then the website, if people want to learn more about your firm?
Sure. It's www.bella, B-E-L-L-A, webdesign.com. And Doug, I got to tell you, back in 1998, when I started my company, we chose Bella because B was, you know, right there when everything was listed. It was alphabetically on Yahoo. We were right there, number two. And that's why. And you know what? We did not. We made a mistake, and we didn't trademark the name until just a few years ago. So there's some Bella Webworks, Bella. Yeah, so we got caught, but that's okay. Because there's only one Bella Web Design.
That's
trust
right.
me.
All right, you're going to stay with us while we visit our final guest, our headliner for the day.
You bet.
The guy bringing it all home. Terrific. Well, thanks so much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you.
All right, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, we have with us, bringing it all home and wrapping the segment today, Mr. Larry White with The Rich Group. How you doing, man?
I'm doing fine. Welcome.
Well, it's good to have you back. You raising a bunch of money and helping some folks get some businesses started out there?
We're trying, and I'd like to congratulate Business Radio X on what a fine year you've had. And thank you for supporting the Ritz Group. And it was fun visiting with you, particularly at Venture Atlanta, which is coming up very shortly.
Yeah.
And so it's been a terrific year for the Ritz Group.
Well, we're delighted to do it, and we think the world what you guys are out there doing. And maybe we'll get a chance to participate in Venture Atlanta again. I don't know what the logistics on that are, but hanging out with people who are starting new companies and the people that are mentoring and providing some funding for that, it's invigorating. It's great. You cannot go home and not just be thrilled with life after you hang out with those folks for the day. You must love every day of your work.
Well, I do. Well, I really do. And it's frustrating in some respects in the fact that you can't help them all.
Yeah.
So our goal really with the Ritz Group was to try and improve Georgia's status for funding companies. We're number 17 by a lot of measurements. And not to disparage anybody from Pittsburgh, but they're 14. So there's obviously – and we're doing so much within the city with the organizations that are participating with helping entrepreneurs and growing businesses. And so there's really no excuse to that. So one of the reasons that the Ritz Group, one of the challenges was to try and bring the community together and work with all the other communities, not as competitors, but as partners. One of the first things we did last year, and as I look at our last year, we've been doing this for 26 years, but my company just purchased it a year ago. And one of the things that we wanted to do since we were in the technology business was build an online community. Obviously, Desiree, a brand new website, and to bring the people together in a true social media environment, recognizing there are a lot of national websites for entrepreneurs, Angel List, Circle Up, and some more things going on. But we needed to be able to communicate with everybody here locally. We did that, and I'm proud to say we have 450-plus members on our collaborative community, which means you've got colleagues, not friends, but you've got all of the blogging capability. And again, that's a private site. We're all into the ability to privately solicit private equities versus publicly solicit.
And so this is a home to do that. On the site is people who have businesses that need funding and plus people who have money that want to fund businesses?
It's Match.com for private solicitation for money, and we also include service processors there because they do move the ball.
Right.
And that's important because both sides really literally need some help.
Well, sure. Maybe you should get bellamoney.com if it's not.
Yeah, please.
So how about this whole crowdfunding movement? Is that impacting your world? It's got to be, right?
Oh, it's tremendous. And it's an important part of the food chain. And food chain both for raising funds, but also now with the SEC rulings for raising equity funds. And last year we had – one of the things that we launched was our Shark Attack. And Shark Attack is really a takeoff of Shark Tank, except ours is more edutainment. The sharks do not invest in the business, but they really comment on the investor readiness of the companies. So we – and the reason that we wanted the sharks was because that gets engagement in the community from our icons and some people that have had a cash out. Those are the ones that really drive the entrepreneurial economy. If you've just – when you and Stone, when you and Lee make millions of dollars and when Business Radio X goes national, you're going to come back and participate with the community, I'm absolutely certain. And we need to honor those. And that's what Shark Attack did. We brought 23 of the best icons to the Ritz Group this year. We also featured 23 of the best entrepreneurs, which we screened through our pitch camp, all of which was online, using some of the latest tools. My goal in the Ritz Group was to bring technology to the platform and to help the entrepreneurs. Your question was crowdfunding. Where are we going with crowdfunding? We had a Shark Attack with all crowdfunding. We brought three experts in to talk about what's happening with crowdfunding. I'll cover that in a second. We brought in, and I interviewed probably 16 to 17 crowdfunding companies to select the three that were going to present. And the purpose was to pick the best crowdfunding campaign and who had done the best. And what I learned from that experience was there were none that hit it the first time. They had done three or four campaigns, so they learned that the important thing was marketing.
Yeah.
You know, and you talked about video being important, and no one would think about doing a crowdfunding campaign if it were not for video.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit about crowdfunding? Because is it baked and ready for people to fund, or and where is, like, is it a state by state thing?
Well, it's both. It's all of the above. Let's talk a little bit. There are two types of really crowdfunding, to boil it down in its simplest terms. First is for product or rewards. All right. That has nothing to do with equity. Second is equity.
Like Kickstarter, where there's a project or mm-hmm. somebody's making a movie or mm-hmm. whatever, and you can invest and you get a T-shirt or a credit for mm-hmm. that thing. So mm-hmm. that's already legal and anybody can do that right now?
That's exactly right. You don't have to be SEC.
Right.
You're not offering private securities, which is run by the SEC. And why that is so very, very important is because young companies can now get their product produced and generate the revenue to produce a product. Pebble Watch is an example. Okay, but there are so many others. If I wanted to raise $100,000 to build a product, you know, and the product that I would have in mind was like a birthday app. Okay.
Hypothetically.
There's a lot of people promoting.
I think we'd get the show back on track.
I know. Birthday. Happy birthday.
So I could raise, and I don't have the money to produce that app, but if I went to the crowd and I had a birthday app and I had a lot of people, particularly named Stone, that did that, and they all contributed $50 and I raised, you know, my $20,000 or $30,000 to raise that, then I could produce that. Now, that is tremendous proof of principle to an angel investor of two very important criteria. The first is that I have the marketing savvy to create a Kickstarter type, whether it's Kickstarter, Indiegogo, app that appeals to the consumers, or as they say in the business, the consumers.
Right, so Eric, that's like a focus group, right?
It is. Yes.
The internet and crowdfunding sites are the world's biggest and best focus mm-hmm. group. But it proves the second issue. It says that I can manage my social media play. All right, because that's what drives the Kickstarter campaign is the social media play. So if I'm in a consumer business and I'm trying to convince an investor that I can manage a B2C product, then and I have a successful crowdfunding campaign, it proves two very, very critical issues. Now, the second thing that everybody's excited about with the Jobs Act that passed last year is now I can use this same crowd to do what? Raise private securities. Now, that's a whole different ballgame. Right? It still says that we should absolutely, okay, be compliant. And it says, like, we are very compliant. We have specific rules when we do a private solicitation. But when we're doing a public solicitation, as it was just announced, okay, then we have new rules because the government's role is to make sure that we don't rip off Granny from her pension. Not that anybody with a birthday app would ever do that. But, you know, that's what the government's role is. And you have to take that in. So the government, and through the SEC, which is the governing arm of that to set the rules, is going to set rules for the amount that you can raise. It's going to set rules on who you can raise it with, the investor. And it's going to set rules on the venue raising the money. And they've done that. I think the rule is you can raise $10,000 per individual. So the most I can get from any one individual is $10,000. The most I can raise as an entrepreneur is $1 million. All right? And I have to raise it through I have to take a reasonableness test that the person that I'm raising the money for is an accredited investor. Now, the government set safe harbor rules, the SEC set safe harbor rules on reasonableness test, which is the following, which is kind of surprising. It gets into the paradigm of what's going on. The reasonable test is that they have to be an accredited investor, which says I have to have $1 million in net worth, and I can't include my home. It says I have to make $200,000 a year for the last 2 years, and it's now in crowdfunding equity, the entrepreneur's requirement to attest to this, and they can do that by looking at W-2s. They can look at the investor's IRS statements, or they can have a broker certify or an investment banker certify that they meet the criteria, and if you do it that way, then they have to do that every quarter. Now, my question to you is, what investor in their right mind is going to do that? It's not going to happen. When in the private security rule, the private security world that we now deal with, I as an investor can self-authenticate that I'm accredited. And it's not the responsibility of the entrepreneur. So you're going to see in this scenario, now I think the SEC, to bring up to speed, will pare this down and get it right. I really hope they do. We have a lot of benefits of crowdfunding we've explained earlier with on the non-security side. But on the security side, the investor now will migrate back to the non-solicited private investment that we have today. You ask about intra and interstate. Georgia just passed an ESG rule law that said, oh, you can do crowdfunding for equity, and you don't have to have an accredited investor, if, as long as it's a Georgia company and it's a Georgia investor. So they've skirted the federal laws, which is neat because it was designed to foster young restaurants or young businesses within a community or a collaboration authority. And that's neat for business, and that's a wonderful opportunity.
So is that really an ongoing thing right now, or is everybody waiting for the federal SEC ruling to come down?
No.
So right now
– that has nothing to do with the federal FEC because it's intrastate.
Okay. So within the state, an investor and a business, as long as they're both from Georgia, can figure this out in a crowd way, but the crowd is just limited to Georgia.
That's right. And I can now publicly solicit that I'm raising equity or private securities as long as I stay intrastate. Now the problem with that is that we don't have any Kickstarters crowdfunding in Georgia yet.
There's no Georgia-based social media network that'll match these people up.
A crowdfunding network, right. Yeah, like a Kickstarter for Georgia. Now there are two starting and just rolling out, and a third one, and they're all specializing in a different area. One was a benevolent, and the other two are focusing across the board. So they are evolving, and there will be. There's over 6,000 crowdfunding sites all sort of waiting to see where this is all going. So we're really pleased with this as a part of the food chain, which means that now you're going to max your credit cards, okay? You're going to then attack your family and friends at birthday parties and just anywhere you can, okay? You're then going to you've got an option to go to your banks. We've got a great opportunity with peer-to-peer lending, which is non-bank banks trying to get into the game that the banks can no longer play with because of the regulation. And then we have crowdfunding, okay, that can raise money on not a debt but a product basis. And now we're into this new area of crowdfunding for securities in the public solicitation, and then our traditional private solicitation where we have angels and VCs and then VCs on that. So crowdfunding is just an important part of our whole food chain, our funding food chain.
Now, the Ritz Group, where do you guys fit into all this?
Well, we're going to have, again, last year we had a shark attack on crowdfunding. We're going to have another shark attack on this year with crowdfunding and with the latest experts. A TV show on crowdfunding, so it's in vogue. It's by some the wild, wild west. I hope I've painted a little different picture than that, but because it's going to be regulated. But it's an important part of what we do with the Ritz Group. We have got to move the entrepreneurs through the food chain. If you don't do that, and this is a very intense food chain. If you don't have the right web collateral, Desiree, this is not going to work. If you haven't mastered the marketing aspects, Eric, of crowdfunding, okay, and the social media side of that, you're not going to have the proof items that the angel investors really are requiring before they're going to lay down a dollar. It's the world's new paradigm of focus groups.
Right.
You've got to have a proof of principle. So the Ritz Group is going to be front and center in doing that. We're taking our shark attack to the broadcast media in terms of whether it be GPTV, and there are a lot of other channels that are popping up just for entrepreneurs. We would like to thank Bob Rathburn. It's been a tremendous show. I was so glad. He's the broadcaster for the Hawks. And he just took that to a level of professionalism, and we webcast it live. And so now we'd like to take that into the broadcast media And as, again, as edutainment, and there's so much channel bandwidth down there, and it's easier for us to track sharks. I laugh and talk to people about the fact I burnt my good wood, my good shark wood last year. So we're always looking for more winners and more sharks, but that's going to help that play.
Well, we got to have you back because I want to talk more about this pitch camp, and I think it would be fun, your next round of sharks, maybe we run them through the studio, I don't know, a couple of weeks out from the event, or maybe some of the folks that are participating in pitch camp, because it is always so inspiring, so invigorating to have you come in and get us caught up on what's going on in this world. So we got to have you back, man.
I'd love to come back.
There's always more to talk about, isn't there?
We could go on and on and on.
All right, so let's make sure, though, for today's segment that our listeners have coordinates where they can reach out, learn more about pitch camp, Shark Attack, the whole bit.
It's www.richgroup.org.
All right. Well, Lee, this has been a fun segment.
Yeah, learned a lot.
Until next time, this is Stone Payton for Lee Cantor and everyone here at the Business Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.